the podcast that watched Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 46 of If This Is a Podcast and What's Christmas. This is my sixth chat with Dave Dye. So what's that? About every six and a half episodes is a chat with Dave, which is great because he's full of interesting stories from a very good perspective, seems to have a very good memory about all the good stuff that went on, which is great. And those of you who have been on Tenterhooks since episode 5, I don't know when that was, but I'm sure you've been sitting there like the end of an episode of EastEnders going, my God, what happened next? So you'll find out now. There's lots of interesting stuff here, partly because it's a more conventional agency structure than CDD. It wasn't three creatives. It was a creative, a planner, and an account person. So from that point of view, I think it's all very interesting because it's a more normal ad agency setup. So you can find out all the where's and why for us about trying to get business and what happens when you get it or you don't get it and how it happens and doesn't happen, which I think is all very interesting. Then at the end, we have a bit of a chat about digital because I heard Dave talk about that a little bit in his chat with the ad contrarian, Bob Hoffman. Go and find that on Dave's blog. It's a good chat like all his podcasts are. And we kind of discuss a perspective on that because I've been looking at a lot of that recently. One other thing to say, apologies, the sound quality it's 90-something percent perfect, but there's some little bits here and there that it goes a little bit weird. I thought I'd hit on a perfect formula of doing Skype audio and seem not to have done so, or it's gone back to being a little bit dodgy, so apologies for that. Try and overlook it and enjoy my chat with Dave.
Okay, so thanks for the sixth, and I don't know if it'll be the final time. I hope not. We can have another chat at some point in the future, of course. But this is, I guess, coming on to the latter stage of, you know, and probably going up to the sort of present day thing. So thanks very much for taking the time for a sixth hour of conversation, Dave.
I know, it's incredible. But it's your fault, Ben. You keep asking, so.
I know. But you're
I listen to some people that you talk to, and they go quickly and think I've done loads of stuff. But I'm probably the spectrum, but anyway.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird one because sometimes you go, well, you person I'm interviewing must have tons and tons of stuff, and this will take hours and hours and hours. And then suddenly, sort of, we're three quarters of the way through their career and it's 20 minutes gone, and I'm going, oh my God, how are we going to fill the rest of the time? But no such problems with you. That's fine. And, I guess if anyone's following this and has listened to part 5, I guess that was reflecting on how CDD sort of came to its conclusion. And I guess then chronologically, what happened to you after that?
I kind of felt a bit bad the way and frustrated. You know, I thought the most positive thing I could do rather than take a job, which was incredibly tempting because it's tough starting companies and, you know, trying to grow it and being involved in all that sort of that kind of stuff. I sort of actively said to sort of didn't talk to people, or when people wanted to, you know, talk to me about a particular job, said I'm not going to take one, which was tough because there's some interesting things come up, and whether stupidity or stubbornness or whatever, I thought the only way to kind of get it out of my system is to sort of take what I've learned and put it to positive use, start another company with hopefully better knowledge. So I kind of spent about the best part of a year, I was either at Fallon or, I'm trying to think what we did, Red Brick Road with Paul Silverman. I spent a long time working with Paul, and who had just come back from Fallon in the States, and we worked together. I tried to convince him to do an agency with the people I was doing it, because we sort of tried over the years to get together at different stages, either at Lowe's with him or Legas with me or different points, but it never kind of worked out. But anyway, so we worked together for quite a long time. We did some quite nice stuff. The Looka Loco stuff come out and seemed to do very well at some awards, and various other things. We did freelance here, there, and everywhere. In that time, I was kind of interviewing people with the goal of setting up an agency. So I'd kind of printed a letterhead that said die... ampersand... and then thought, got to go back to the three structure. Perhaps the three creatives didn't really work. There's a lot of issues there. Everybody, the mainly successful agencies, had an account guy, a planner, and a creative, and it's kind of still the same now, really. Even the agents are set up now, it's a very straightforward thing. So then I kind of set about looking for those people in the dot, dot, dots. So pretty quickly I got to Jorin, who I'd worked with twice, once at Publicis and once at BMP. He was, I suppose, once you've had a I think you always sort of swing from opposites. So I kind of had a experience where I felt some of the people I was partners with weren't very trustworthy. So trust becomes the big issue, you know, too much really. It becomes all about who is the most decent, trusting. And so I kind of got together with Jorian, who was then MD of BNP DDB, as it was. He'd run the Volkswagen account for about 20 years. Really good, very nice guy. And then we set about interviewing various planners to try and do it. This is about the end of 2007, I think it was. Difficult, because when you're interviewing people either for partners in account management or planning, generally they're good. Generally, you know, you don't have that many meetings where you think, oh, the disaster, he's clueless. They're generally pretty good. So, you know, you obviously speak to people from good agencies. They're generally smart. So it was kind of tricky, but we ended up with Justin, who was very good, just back from America, where he'd kind of done some really famous things. So the three of us kind of got together, kind of made plans to set up an agency.
And what were those plans, and what did you have to do next? Were you three guys in a kitchen, one of your kitchens, or did you go and find some premises?
We would meet up and try and plot things out as much as you can do. I mean, one of the big things became the name. I was kind of very keen on, so I'd kind of got that out. The name on the door thing was out of my system, and I thought it felt wrong for the time. You know, there was lots of agencies starting up with different names now, and it felt like the whole debate at the time was there was this traditional tag was hung over basically every agency. So you didn't want to be that. I mean, it's an unfortunate thing. If it was, you know, it could just have been Mass and Niche, or, you know, there could have been different tags, but traditional felt like Victorian almost, you know. It felt like such a damning thing at the time. And again, that's something that as time has gone on, it seems to have softened and not be an issue. But at the time, it was a big, big thing. So the name that I really wanted to be called was Thingy, because I suppose the names that I really liked, it was sort of almost like a rip-off of two names that I really loved, which was Anomaly. It's a cool word, and I like the fact that it was difficult to pin down exactly what it is. It allowed you flexibility to change shape as you went forward and sounded modern. And I always remember the thing when Gorgeous set up, Chris has said he liked the idea of people answering the same phone saying, "Hello, Gorgeous."
Yeah.
So I thought Thingy would be great. So if you want a piece of business, you'd say Thingy wins, Mercedes, or Hello Thingy, or... It seemed to say you can sort of morph into different shapes and you were difficult to pin down. It was kind of funny, and it would work great in the press. So, but obviously with Justin and Jorian had come from BNP DDB, and I think not having done it before, that just seemed so flip. So they kind of liked it, but then really worried that, well, could you imagine that, you know, Volkswagen appoint Thingy, just seems flip. And, it's one of those things. Everybody goes through this naming thing. I remember when we talked to Ben Priest about it, all the different names, and in the end you just run out of steam and go, okay, let's call us that, whatever that may be, or when the music stops. So there's a lot of debates about it, you know, all these kind of, you know, the more you think about it and the more you try and accurately pin it down, the more pretentious they sound. So the default is always your names. So in the end, you know, I would mock up letterheads and PR releases and stories and campaign, Thingy wins this thing. But in the end, that's kind of voted the game. It was, so we had to dial over it, which was the sort of the only. It was like almost like a non-decision. It's like, well, you know, it doesn't. Everybody may have had their favourites, but that was the one that kind of was least offensive. But it was, in retrospect, it was a really big decision because it just said at the wrong time, traditional. Which, you know, to be fair, we were. You know, we were out of traditional agencies. And we'd spent that time in those. But it wasn't a good signal to send out.
Was there any conversation about the order of the names?
No, just alphabetical. You know, I'd had this thing, I think when we did CDD, that I'd kind of noticed that all the agencies that had issues that set up, the names weren't alphabetical. So yeah, where the partners had gone, so being geeky. So like White Collins, rather Scott, most of the creative partners had gone. I'm trying to think what the others were now, but there were loads of them. The ones that have been... The ones that were in alphabetical order, like BBH,
AMV,
Abbott Mead Vickers, yeah. The successful ones, stuck to that. And I thought, well, there's a sort of sign that it's just, there's no one arguing that this one should be in front of that one, but the other ones tended to have issues where the partners were. I mean, it's not to say that that definitely happens. I remember saying that to David Abbott once, and he went, yeah, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. That's a complete different. But it was true that lots of the ones that are not alphabetical. So I think we went to Holloway Murray, rather than the back from the last ages, which was a bonus.
And how were you sort of greeted in the press in that way? What was the... I think it's interesting how, you know, you start and what's the story? Was there a story there?
It was true that we'd all worked at Publicis, but it was like 20 years before and we weren't all there at the same time. Ironically, we'd all worked at BMP, and two of them had come straight from BMP, and I'd come from BMP like 8 years earlier. I wouldn't have considered calling it a BMP breakaway, but for some bizarre reason, it sort of shows you that you have to take responsibility. We have to take responsibility for that and think somehow that they wrote that. Rather than BMP breakaway. So that was, again, that was the second bad thing. So all of a sudden you start, and it's easier in retrospect to think, three names says traditional, Publicis then, you know, it's improved in certain areas now, but then was not a good tag.
That does sound weird because, you know, when they say breakaway, it has to have sort of been, in my mind, the three people or four people, whatever, were at that agency and now they've left that agency. Like Adam and Eve is a breakaway kind of Rainey Kelly. But I wouldn't have described anything a breakaway if you hadn't all directly come from there. So it's a bit weird how that happened.
Well, it is weird and annoying, yeah, because it's not... two had come direct from BMP and I'd been there... And direct from BMP and I'd been there far more recently than Publicis. How they wrote it up as... Publicis, I've still got no idea. But the problem is, once these things go out, other people refer to that as, you know, they pass these things around. It's a bit like Wikipedia once it goes on that. So that was a pain. So two unplanned things very early, which were mad, which you think you have to better or that's in our hands, you know.
And... If I remember, another thing that was slightly different was you called yourself commissioning editor rather than creative director, which to me made a lot of sense. And I think that there's a lot of things with advertising, people still like to cling to old ways of doing things, partly because, you know, everyone knows what a creative director is supposed to be, but, you know, things should move on and kind of change. And I guess that's what you did.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, because of the climate then, I suppose those were my two clear things that I wanted, a name thingy so that we were difficult to pin down, you know, we could be anything, and then to be called commissioning editor, because at the time, I'm trying to think when BMW Films would have been around, a bit before that.
Yeah.
I suppose at the time I thought that I was excited about the fact that instead of gambling tons of money on traditional media, you could gamble tons of money on creative stuff. But if you kind of pooled your budgets and use that money in different ways, you know, perhaps to get big stars to do slightly cheaper films that you could put on the net, or there's different ways you could use it, I thought that would be a better way to go. And effectively, I thought it'd be much more, by now I thought advertising would be very different than it is. It's still very similar, really, to how it was before we set up. I thought it'd be very different. So I like it. So I thought, rather than this sort of model of, you know, essentially creative directors are overseeing people saying, no, I think you need to do that again, I think it should be this, you want to try this, you want to try that, I thought it would be much better to cast, particularly as a new company, to cast, to bring in people from the outside. You know, so if you're trying to create a some sort of funny piece of content online, get funny people rather than some ad creators. You know, let's look wider and pull people in. If you're advising someone to start making a magazine, if it's a luxury company, rather than, you know, doing press ads, then essentially you're commissioning people and you're sort of, you know, you're steering them a bit, but it's a different relationship. You're asking them rather than creative directing them. So I think it's a really good title now, but the downside is that, you know, you do a picture or chemistry meeting and then it's whatever it be, CEO, MD. So Justin planning, this is Dave, he's the Christian editor. I go, oh, what's that? He go, well, it's, you know, what it is, and I'd go through the stuff that you've said, and still look blank. I go, it's a creative director, really, you know. And they go, okay. It would be really difficult for people to get their head around, and you'd end up going, well, you know, like, well, I sort of creative director. And go, oh, okay, I've got it. So it kind of just seemed to slow things down. I mean, I stuck with it for a few years. And it's a shame. I think, you know, I think it's a better, more modern description of probably what we should be doing. Anyway, that was the plan. Also, the commissioning thing was to not have everybody on site, to dip into very high level talent for a number of days in different, with different skill sets, not just advertising. But anyway, so that was that. That was the plan. Anyway,
cool. And how did you go about getting your first clients? Because I guess remembering the CDD story and the Mercedes and that kind of thing was something that happened through Peter Mead. Was the starting from complete scratch the situation this time? And if so, how did you go about it?
How did you go about it? Not brilliantly well. I think we Howie was very early on, which was small, but a really great account, which through a friend of mine, Dave Hyatt, who set it up. You know, and you speak to the people that you know, to in the past. You know, so we ended up, we got Adnams and the McCallan from CDD eventually, but not instantly. You know, everybody would talk to clients that they used to work with or they knew, but it didn't really have a very... You know, it's very difficult when you work out these plans. You know, I always think it's so weird. We might have talked about this before, but where your business proposal is just, I don't, it just seems to make no sense to me. You go in year, in the first quarter, we win X, and then in the second quarter, we'll win Y, and then in the third quarter, we'll win X again. And you work out your business plan, and you go, well, what is X and Y? And they go, oh, we have no idea. So it's so pie in the sky. It's just bizarre. We didn't have a piece of business or pitch line or a big pitch lined up. We sort of set up on the sort of if we build it, they will come system that people talk about. And then I think we got a first pitch from the AAR, this pitch. Smooth, which was reasonably good. It was like about £4 million that they were spending on media, you know, and the fee was about 10% or something. We kind of mapped out the room. Jury went to see the room first. We did a lot of work. So we're all kind of hyped up with it. But then in the meeting, it was we got moved to a smaller room. We had these big rolls of paper that we were going to kind of cover the room that all fitted perfectly. And it was like just long rolls that were printed out of a printer and to go through. They didn't quite fit. We blue tacked them up and they were falling down. It was so we had a really good idea, but it was a disaster of a meeting. It was just, anyway, I don't know. It went, we had a great, really neat idea, but it was an uncomfortable, awkward meeting because things seemed to keep going wrong. Jorin may even have spilled a jar of water or something. It was one of those, just didn't work. So anyway, we did that. We were out, and then 2 weeks later, I got a call from Martin Jones. Hopefully, this is not giving away any trade secrets, but he said, "Can I have a word with you?" So I said, "Yeah, of course." He said, I'll come over in about an hour." So Martin turned up and said, "I've got a really awkward situation here." So I said, "Okay, what's that?" He went, "Well, the guys at Smooth have put your work into research against the agencies that they chose." So I said, "Oh, it's weird. I thought they didn't like it." He said, "No, they liked it, but, you know, they weren't sure." And he said, "It's done really well." I said, "All right. Well, why is that awkward? What's the situation then?" "Well, I don't know how you'd feel about it." So I said, "Well, I feel great about it. That can only be good, can't it?" And he said, "Well, do you want to have a chat with them?" So we'd done this thing based on a sort of fad at the time called sleeve facing, where people would hold up albums in front of their face.
Yeah.
So that it looked like, you know, you've got the body of Ben and the head of George Michael. And so we kind of done that, and they said, "Look, we'll give you the account, but we want you to confirm that you can do that and it's not owned by anyone." So then we had to do a bit of research, track down the guy who'd supposedly first done it. I don't know whether we give him some money or some sweets or something. I don't know what the system was, but essentially we got an agreement that we could, that's not an issue. And then, so we got that account, you know, by kind of, I suppose, I don't know if it's luck or not, but really they, you know, our work wasn't going into research. So all of a sudden that was like a proper thing, that first thing that was paid some actual money, that paid some bills and did something that meant we could hire people and do stuff.
Cool. So, but you had other bits and pieces at that time as well. And were they not bill paying things? And were they accounts where it was sort of giving you legitimacy as an agency?
Yeah. I mean, we had a whole bunch of stuff that was small, fiddly things that probably cost us money rather than, you know, to try and generate some stuff. So we'd done a campaign for Posterscope that was, you know, it was like a big thing in terms of media. They sort of blitzed London with about 20 different executions.
Yeah.
But we did that for free. We did a load of stuff for free for a thing I might write a blog about, which was a company phoned us and said, you know, we'd be interested in you doing our advertising. So great. They said, "Do you want to come to Birmingham to discuss it?" So we went to Birmingham to meet a couple in this big factory that had, they had a little corner in this factory that was called Urban Fresh Fruit. And it was just a husband and wife. There was no employees, no anything. It just got going. And they said, "Oh, we haven't got any money." Well, that's a bit annoying given that we've all traveled up here at our cost for a prize of nothing at all. But they were really nice and we ended up, did quite a lot of work for them. And the good thing was at that time we were trying to do things to offset our name, our traditional name, do things in as many different channels as we could, even if it was like, you know, in-store for anything that was going, you know, packaging, in-store, anything. So we did all sorts of things for them and they would pay us in dried pineapple.
How much dried pineapple do you get for doing work like that?
Quite a big bag. And it was very nice. You know, they were really into the quality of the pineapple, but you can't really pay your rent or staff with that. We thought, you know, so we did posters and things and stuff for them. They barely had any money. The irony is we did actually talk to them about, well, do we just take a gamble and say, look, we'll continue doing this, maybe for a 1% or something at the company, or 2%. And it was sort of debate that went on and, you know, we would do a poster for them and they would sell it. And so loads of them. You know, it's quite a neat thing, I think, if you're born. Anyway, the conversations broke down about this 1% or 2% or what's the right way to get some payment other than just pineapple. And they sold a couple of months ago for $60 million, the company, which was nice. So we did Mamma Mia, Cosmet, all these kind of, anybody who walked past the door we'd do some ads for. You know, we thought let's just do as much stuff as we can, which again meant we'd done a lot of work early on, but probably distracting with all these fiddly things, trying to make all these tiny little things visible and good. But I don't know, you know, you sort of, what do you do with your time? But I think, so I suppose we had a number of things, and Howie's was very busy. Howie's had been bought by Timberland, and the plan was Dave had sold it to get investment to expand abroad and for them to really sort of take it to another level. And there was like a lot of work required across lots of different medium at the time. And because he was my mate, obviously you wanted to do it as well as possible. Or there's just an extra bit of responsibility when you work for people you know. It's, so we were very busy, but the things were too small, really. But obviously we did a lot of work in that first year. And then I guess at the same time, just to make it slightly busy, I was doing a Creative Circle annual with Mark Denton, which typically, rather than doing a cool cover, we did a thing that required thousands of man hours and more Mark towards the end than me. But yeah, we did a really complicated, complex, but it's cool. It was a cool annual. So that was kind of the bulk of most of our first year, I guess, getting going. And then, of course, 9 months into it, or 6 months into it, the worldwide global crash comes.
Oh, yeah.
Which wasn't great either. So I think we'd set up 2 weeks before 9/11 last time at CDD, and then 6 months before the 2008 global crash.
Just on the Crepe Circle annual, that reminded me of were you in the awkward David Abbott conversation there about the drawing that was done of him, or were you?
I was.
Not?
Yeah, that was horrendous.
Did you want to mention that?
That was so we did this annual. It's like virtually every page had to be designed, and then at the last minute, Mark came up with this idea. Said, shouldn't we have little tiny bits of text at the top of each page that say, you know, Billy Whiz, he's full of Jews, or whatever the silly thing is at the top. But you had to relate it, obviously, to the whatever's going on the page below it. So I thought, God, he's bloody right, but that means we've got to write hundreds of these fucking things. So we divided them up and crashed out loads of these things. So one of the ones in my stack of ones to do was David Abbott was getting the president's talk. So I'd written down about 8 different. I mean, there's not much logic other than you're trying to rhyme something with something. It's sort of easy on one level, you know. It's not hard. But so I'd written a load of these things down, and then opposite was my mate Billy Mead, and walked them over as they asked. Like, I've written a load of these silly things, David. What do you think? Anything you like? And he went, "Oh, I like that one. That's funny." So it said, he's Abbo, he's original, but he's now Aboriginal. So I don't really know what it means, but it vaguely rhymes. So I thought, oh, sod it, that should do. Didn't really think about it much. So then, of course, as these things work, six months later, the book is finished. We get the first one off the presses to me. At the same time, we'd had a pitch come up for Volkswagen commercial vehicles. So Jorian had worked for 20 years on Volkswagen. I used to work on Volkswagen. Justin was the planner on Volkswagen before setting up with us. And obviously if you get a piece of Volkswagen early on, it was quite a big thing as well financially. Yeah, it's been amazing. So I thought, the crash has just happened. Volkswagen are more expensive vans than the competition. So you've got to justify that premium, and it's Volkswagen. So we need someone who understands, a writer who understands business, can sort of persuade people that it's worth spending the extra money in a recession to get something reliable, et cetera, et cetera, becomes a brew. And I was thinking, like David Abbott's kind of stuff, you know, where it's not just a neat line or a little flip thing. There's a good rational understanding of business behind it. And so I couldn't think of anyone, obviously, like David Abbott who we could get. So I thought, well, let's ask David Abbott. So we asked him, and he said, yeah. So then the first meeting to go through it, the book turns up literally like an hour before I've got to go to his little flat near Peter Jones to talk about it. So I thought, sorry, I'll take that. That's a nice thing to give him. He's the president. Not really thinking anything other than he's got the president's award. There's the book. It's a nice little icebreaker to talk about this thing. So I'll go around to his flat, and it's all classical music, faded first editions, coffee on the go, you know, brewing or something baking. It's all very perfectly set. And giving this very garish Beano annual. So, of course, he does what we'd all do, which is go straight to your page. There's a horrific cartoon of him with his tongue out and a hole in his shoe trying to scribble some headlines. And then goes straight to... He's Abbo, he's original, but he's no Aboriginal. And looks literally shocked, like someone's, you know, prodded him. He looked genuinely quite shocked. And then just closed it and put it to one side and said, oh, let's talk about this Volkswagen thing. And didn't even reference it. It's really awkward. And then a bit later, he called me to say, Dave, I'm so sorry, I didn't realise you'd actually designed that book. I said, yeah, it didn't really seem to fit in. Looking around, it didn't seem to blend in with the other stuff. But no, I'm sure I'll find somewhere for it. Presumably the bean or somewhere was the tone. But, so that was awkward. But it ended up, you know, we did a pitch together that was great. It was really good working with him. You know, it was really good. And initially, he didn't want to do it because he said, I'm terribly rusty. But possibly the last things he did actually added in.
And what was it like being his commissioning editor then? Because, like, I guess David's never really worked into anyone other than himself, maybe up until that point.
What was the question again?
You were his commissioning editor. You were probably the first one he'd had since, like, John Withers or someone like that. So how was that?
Kind of. I mean, I didn't consider me in charge. I mean, I think if you're commissioning editor or creative director, you can't, and you've got David Abbott, you go, this is the brief. What do you think? We should do it, really. You know, I had a sort of, I'd written a lot of ads that I had to almost kind of go, well, this, play them down. You know, I quite like some of them, but say, look, there's these, but, you know, I don't know, we'll do something else. And he took some of them and that he liked and wrote copy for some of them. And I think, so over the period of working with him on that project, he went from being a bit uncertain, what do you think of this and what do you think of that, to taking control, you know, as he'd been to the groove a bit. He probably hadn't done ads for, I don't know, I can't figure out what the dates were, but it felt like he said, oh, I'm a bit rusty, and he wasn't sure. But then once he got into it, he was like, should be this, it shouldn't be that, should be that. So it was, which is great, it's what you want. Mm. So it was good. And I think he, you know, it's funny on that one. It sounds like a made up story, but when we actually pitched on the day, and it literally sounds like the sort of thing you'd make up. We pitched and he'd written various ads, and he'd done copy for some of the ones I'd done and copy for some of the ones I did. And I read out his copy to all the clients, a room full of clients. And I read one, and the client went, that's good. And I said, oh, thanks. And then I read another one, that's really well written. She's just so weird. Clients never say that.
Yeah.
And then I read the third one, and they went, that's really well written. Who wrote that? And what I forgot to say is I said to everybody at DHM, I don't want this to be a campaign story. I don't want it to look like we're abusing that we've asked him to get involved so that we can say, oh, we've got David Abbott involved and he used to do Volkswagen, because it would be really low rent. We're working with him because of what he can write, not because we think that might be an angle on trying to help us win the business.
Sure. So when you told, I guess you told the client that David Abbott wrote them, and then what do they say?
Who wrote that? Really awkwardly. I mean, who says, what do clients care?
It's so weird.
It was Bob, it was Jeff.
Yeah.
So what? So I then don't know what to say because I'm thinking, well, what do I say now? I've told everyone not to say anything. Can I say in the meeting? I don't even, you know. So I'm sort of slightly smirk at juror thinking, shit. So he says, the client says, was it you? I'm thinking it's me that I'm being marmy that I've written it. So I said, no. And he went, well, who was it? Why is it such a big thing? So juror went, well, tell him. So I said, it was David Abbott. And I swear on my heart, one of the clients went, David Abbott in parts. David Abbott, who works in the parts department. And I said, no. And the other one went, said, what, the David Abbott? And I went, yeah. And he went, oh, well, would he be working on this if we give you the business? I said, yeah, can't say no. And he went, oh. Anyway, so then I had to phone David and said, this happened. And he just laughed. He said, tell me what you want.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Anyway, got distracted there, my. But yeah, so we overcome the Aboriginal thing. He sort of got over that little hump. And unfortunately, we didn't. They loved all the work, and in the end, they said we did the best advertising, but we've given it to Iris because they had a better all-round package. Which is pain because I think it was really good stuff, you know. And it was, yeah, it's good. It's good for the time. You know, it was all about trying to justify the recession and stuff. And it would have been a big deal, you know, for us. It was a good high-profile thing and it was a big fee. But, yeah, there was a debate and we just lost out in the end. It's in the final bit.
But you also had Virtue at that point, did you? Was that a big client that
that was a big client, yeah. That was... Yeah, it was a weird one, that. I mean, I think we kind of got a call. I don't think that was from the AAR. That was someone else. And to pitch for this thing that we'd never heard of it, this phone that ranges from about $1,000 to $90,000. And the brief was, people think we're a bit bling because we're made of gold and got diamonds stuck on it. Can we take the bling out of it? So... God, what a bunch of jokers. Obviously, how do you say, just because we've got diamonds stuck on our phones doesn't mean we're not bling? And it was a global piece of business, and we thought, I don't know how much chance we've got on this. It just feels, and also the brief seems ludicrous. Makes no sense. So we thought, let's just say what we think, which is, the problem isn't that people think you're blingy, it's that people think you're not blingy enough. You know, let's sort of, you have to embrace that. You are what you are. People are out there in the factory sticking diamonds on phones. You know, don't try and say they're functional or, you know, it's got a really good memory in the phone that costs $90,000. So we kind of had a really good presentation where we, you know, we just said, you just have to be more bling. You just have to sort of go with it, but you just have to be more, rather than trying to justify yourself, you have to not justify yourself at all. So most fashion brands have a real attitude and almost arrogance, and you have to go out there and say nothing. Just be like a fashion brand. Be cool. You know, perhaps be associated with people who do things rather than models. So you might get, you know, the guy from who runs Formula One or this guy holding it. And then don't justify a thing. Just be really confident about it. So nobody had kind of done that. Nobody had said your brief's wrong. So they'd had a ton of presentations showing how to de-bling this diamond encrusted phone. And then we said, that's crazy. So then weirdly, we got a call on that. And it was a global piece of business and it was a luxury thing. So the the phone call said, oh, we're giving you the business and it pays X and we've given a figure. So Jordan said, okay, great, that's great. And then he came out and said, I'm not sure whether that's a month or a year. Because it was a lot. And I guess he felt it's really awkward to say, is that a month or a year? You sound really unprofessional. Going, is that a month or a year? And then so it turned out to be a month. So then, yeah, that was a good account. And I think we did quite nice work on that. It certainly did really well for them. It's really, it really helped a lot. So yeah, it was good. It was quite good.
I think we may be getting chronologically up to the time where Daryl and I were squatting in your office on Newburgh Street. That would be early 2009, I guess. Just from the outside, I think the energy was really good in that place. It was like you had, I think, Chris and Fran there, and David and Ollie and other people. So as a vibe, and having Coy kind of upstairs as well, it just felt like there was a lot going on in that building. So it was a really good kind of, I don't know, energy to the place, which was cool.
Yeah, I think we had some good teams, as you say, David, Ollie, Jansen, Chris and Fran. I think you're starting to come together around that time. I can't picture exactly the year you were there. I remember you being there, but obviously I can't remember what year that was. So it felt like it was starting to come together then. I'm trying to think what else we would have won at that point. Maybe Gamers, maybe. And I think also we've done reasonably well at the awards. So I think for about 3 years we'd got quite a lot of stuff in DNED. We'd got nominated every year. So I felt like starting to build, starting to get some decent work together. I'm trying to think what else we would have had at that point. Maybe Breakthrough Breast Cancer. Maybe a few other bits and pieces. We would have had the McCallan Adnams, maybe.
And you worked with other high-end, well, not just David Abbott, but Sean and people like Richard Foster and Andy McLeod as well. And what was it like getting these kind of, because I'd almost have thought, what's the point in even asking some of those guys? I think I knew Richard was freelancing around that time, but you know, that's some amazing high-end kind of talent. And how did you choose to use them rather than, I don't know, what you had in the agency anyway?
I think that my view of freelance was and still is that there's a very, you get a very different thing if you get someone who's good and senior. They work really quickly. And the difficult thing I find when you're getting people to do freelance is that you might get a team in, you know, 400 quid a day for 2 weeks. And at the end of that time, there's nothing that's been presented to the client. It's either just off, or it's just not this, it's just not that. They may have worked on a few things. And that's heartbreaking, because that's a complete waste of money if you're a small business.
Yeah.
Whereas if you get Sean or Richard or whoever, Tony Barry did something for us, they generally nail it in a few days. And it's not off brief, and it's generally either pretty good or very good. It's not so I didn't mind paying people a lot of money for in the long term it worked out cheaper anyway. You know, you pay someone for 3 days a lot of money rather than a few people less money over a longer time. So I just thought it was a better system.
Yeah,
And obviously they bring something different to the. It takes, if you're busy, it takes a bit of weight off you. I think Andy helped us on Right Move. Doesn't need any help. You know, he doesn't need me saying, well, maybe this, maybe that. Really, because you know you're going to end up somewhere. So I preferred that.
Yeah, I remember when we were at Luna, we had Mary do some work, we had Richard Foster do some work, and we worked with Paul Belford as well. And it was just, I mean, I think from mine and Daryl's point of view, they were better than we were anyway. They were like, you know, as far as the writing was concerned, they were kind of legends. And then obviously Paul was an amazing art director. So, you know, we still learned a lot. But you're right, I think
going, this is going to be a shorter period of time, and we know something really good's going to come out of it, was much better than, you know, just trying to sort of hobble along with something where you're not quite sure. So
a lot of agencies now feel much more comfortable getting four lots of teams who are paid very little and haven't done much than getting two guys who've done a ton of stuff, you know. And you think it's just, it costs you more doing that. It gives you loads of options. You get more paper back. But none of that paper might not go forward to the client. So ultimately, it doesn't make sense, you know. I think it's better to trust people and trust the right people. But I don't know, people like options, don't they? Options are the...
Well, they like quantity. I think because you can measure quantity. So people go, look, we've got 45 pieces of paper here. That means we've got value for our money. But one of the clients you did have at that time that I remember was The Economist. And obviously it had been one of the central pillars of AMV for years and years and years. So how did that happen?
Well, I think in those early days when we were in Southampton Street, someone had said, we need some help on The Economist. There's a friend of mine runs a global piece, and he's got a PowerPoint presentation that's all over the place, and he's got to go around the globe presenting it. Could you give him a hand? I think it was about 10 grand or something, so quite a lot for a PowerPoint presentation. But so anyway, so I thought, sod it, The Economist. I'll do anything for The Economist. It's a great little inn. And we could do with the 10 grand. We'd only just started. So I kind of redid his whole PowerPoint presentation. And it was almost like tons of visual posters, really. I'd sort of taken the content and turned it into sort of visual ideas. So it was cool. It was a really neat thing by the end of it. It was quite a lot of work. It's like 100 slides. And then about 6 months later, he said, oh, we may need some ads on the same thing. I said, great. So he said, we need a dozen executions. So I thought, brilliant, you know. So it was to run everywhere, but I think initially it was to run everywhere but the UK. So I think the issue that we had is that it was just at the point where all that, The Economist switched from red to black, essentially, and they'd done a whole bunch of ads with illustrations in that were black.
Yeah.
So I thought, can't really go back to red if that's the thing. We'll have to, if that's their new style, you have to kind of link it into that, which was a pain, which was a shame, really, because it would have been nice to sort of do something in the older, more famous style. And then I thought, well, how do we do them better? You know, I thought those ads were quite nice, but it felt like they'd taken some of the old Economist lines or lines that could have been written in the old style and put some pictures next to them in a sort of almost editorial style. It wasn't like there were visual ideas. It seemed like two things merged together. So I said, well, let's just go completely visual. And I said to the teams, look, we'll know whether we've done a good job. Because if we've done a good job, Abbott Mead will be furious that someone else is working on this and they've done some good stuff. So we did, we ended up, they ran about 12 ads, I think. Some nice ones in that batch, which led to us doing more stuff. There was a really good bits of DM and little bits and pieces that we did, but it was really good quality. We did a pad that got nominated at DNAD that was really cool, the Chris and Fran did. And as it turned out, Abbott Mead were absolutely furious. So, which I guess was a compliment in a way, but it caused us problems. You know, they really didn't like it at all. So there was a lot of pressure put on them to never do anything with us again. So so after a while, that dried up after about a year. But we worked with a lot of very cool clients, but unfortunately it would be bits of them. You know, whether it was Apple or Google or the BBC. So really cool, but not chunky bits of just projects.
Right. And I also remember that the three of you being Arsenal fans at that time, which I thought was really cool. But how long after that did Jurrien leave? Because I think that was after we'd stopped squatting there.
I think it was about 2 years in. I think it's the most difficult. I think when you're the suit, you feel very, very responsible on how much money you're making. And it's obviously not just that person's responsibility on either, but I think you can't really in your discipline. And I think Jurrien, I think he was surprised at how tough it was starting from scratch. You know, it's very difficult if you've been at BNP for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, 500 people, 30 years of amazing work. You know, pitching from that perspective is very different from three blokes sitting in a room in Southampton Street. And it was hard. And I think, about 2 years in, maybe 3 years in, he opted out. It's a shame because I'm still mates with Jurrien and he's a lovely guy. But it was, and also this is post the 2008 recession, which a lot of people were tightening their belts and not spending. But it was just after that crash. It was particularly tough, you know. Which was a shame.
And at what point did you move premises? Because I remember coming in sort of seeing you and talking to you over at Soho Square, and was there a transition there where you were still with Justin, and how was that all going on?
Not really. I think basically, I suppose Justin's view on it was always, if we don't spend too much money, then when we have to close, we wouldn't have wasted anything. So he was always very reluctant to spend money on anything, really. So Justin's thing was they didn't want to spend any money, and I conversely wanted to spend money and take some gambles, and I particularly wanted to get a premises that looked more stable and impressive, and I think that the one in Newburgh Street was great, and but that we just feel like we need to go to the next level. So in debating that, you know, I'd always be on the lookout for property, and nothing ever fit Justin's bill. You know, it was either too cheap, too short term, too long term, too high up in the building, too low down in the building, too central, too, you know, I mean, there's literally, there would be nothing that was right. And in the end, there was one thing that came up that, initially he said, I said, I think it would be great. And he said, I can't do it. And I said, and eventually said, okay, fine. And then he said, because you've said that's fine, if you don't feel comfortable, I'm going to do it. So we kind of went forward and planned to do it, to move to Soho Square. And then in the midpoint, once we'd said we were going for, I think what happened actually, no, I've just remembered, is Newburgh Street was changing hands and we had to leave.
Okay.
So we had to go somewhere, which put the pressure on. And then I found somewhere that was really cool on the corner of Soho Square. And eventually Justin said he was going to do it. Midway, he said, actually, I can't go through with it. So I said, what do you mean? He went, well, I can't do it. I can't commit. I can't sign the lease. So I said, well, we've now a month away. I don't know what our options are. We've got nowhere to. What are you suggesting? So he said, we'll either close down or just contract and just get a little room somewhere and get rid of people. Essentially, I had the option really of either, oh God, so we're going to have to fire a load of people and just stop. We've built a reasonable amount of cash in the bank. So we're pretty stable. So that was the option I had, really, to either stop or me to buy him out and to sign off, and then we continue. which is weird. So, he sort of walked away, really. Although we didn't tell everyone at the time. He didn't want to risk his money in the bank. It'd be better to take that out and walk away than to let it rot. So when we moved over to Soho Square, essentially I was the only partner. Although for about 6 months, maybe 8 months, we carried on as we were, and I paid Justin freelance to try and minimise the sort of disruption as much as possible.
But then, at what point did you change to Hello People in that case? Because you were in those premises for Hello People, weren't you?
We were, yeah. I think, so basically we moved to those premises, sort of confined for a while, and I thought, I can't just do this on my own. It's tough. And I thought, well, we either need to wrap it up or stop, as we move forward. I need to get people in who are very senior to then try and ramp it up. So again, went through an interviewing process with different people and landed on Hugh and Rachel, who'd been CEO and Chief Strategy Officer of Ogilvy, had done a pretty good job. So we'll give it a try. So then we went through the whole name thing again, the hell of the name thing. Thought might as well change that. Went from Octopus at one point. I think another go at bringing Thingy back, which was rejected again. And we ended up with Hello People. I don't think why now. Hello People sounded friendly and cool, and it's all about people, and it's not just tech or data or whatever. It's people at the heart of it. So we came up with that. And then Hugh and Rachel joined.
And around that time, you also did that DNAD cover, didn't you? The one with all the sort of thought process for it.
Probably was a really similar time, actually. 2012, yeah. It's probably my favourite thing I've done, because it's kind of very honest and... I like that. It was a really... I found it a really, really tough brief, and ended up winning that thing for the cover for 2012. It's one of my favourite things. It was 2012 annual. I can't remember when that comes out, like a year later, doesn't it? Whatever the date is, I think it's a year later.
I can't remember now. They seem to change the whole timetable at all, but probably.
I think that's right. If you enter in 2012 and then the book comes out like the following November, I think. So that's probably came out in 2013.
So how many people were you at when you were over in Soho Square?
God, I don't know. I think, I don't know what we would have initially gone over there, maybe 20 and then shrunk. And then I think we had one of those perfect storms. So we went over there. So we had the issues we had is A, half of our capital walked out the door with Justin to continue,
right,
which was a pain because we had quite a chunk of change in there, partly due to Justin not wanting to spend it on the positive. But then when he went, and then we had one of those perfect storms where, Google were going to do this big project and then that evaporated and Adams had a really bad summer, so they said we can't go forward spending, we're not sure when we'll be back, and there's various different things happened. And then that sort of clashed with trying to get up and running with Hello People and pitching for things, which we just didn't win. We just had a comically bad run of pitching for stuff and just not getting it. We were very close, but it means nothing. So we didn't bring in any extra business, and we lost some of the business or the projects or whatever that we had. So so I think it literally lasted like 6 months. I think Hugh said he was really disappointed at the new business funnel that was there when he got there or something weird like that. He said, well, that's obviously why you were there. So it was like a really weird, I don't know. I mean, I kind of thought at that point, just give it a shot or stop. I sort of just thought, I don't want to do the next 10 years standing still. So I kind of rolled the dice. Didn't really work for whatever reason.
And has it put you off wanting to do your own place or not?
A bit. I think you know, having done it twice now, but changed the name various times, but twice. The very difficult thing is winning business. It's kind of 80% of starting an agency, I'd say. And I suppose, you know, when we started CDD, the theory was, that seemed to three naive creatives, is if you do, you know, we'd seen agencies grow like BBH and Abbott Mead and GTT or whatever that did really good work, and then clients went to them for some really good work. You know, it's not much of a business plan.
Yeah.
But that was the kind of thing we thought, if we concentrate, stick to our knitting and try and make the work as good as we can possibly make it, that will attract clients and that will be fine. And I found no evidence of that, really. We did pretty well at the awards at DHM. We did really well at the awards at CDD, but it didn't attract anything extra, other than the usual things that you'd be put on by the AAR because you're in the right bracket. But so I don't know. So that's the very, and it's difficult because that feels like that's not my skill set isn't hustling new business, although that's what you're kind of forced to do when you start up or when you're running your own thing. So that's the sort of tough bit. The actual running it and organising stuff and creating it and all that stuff is great. But Woody Allen says, you've got to keep like a shark. If you're not moving forward, you die. And I think if you feel like you're just static, it has a really bad, it's very difficult to ignore unless you keep bringing in fresh things and growing. So I don't know, possibly that, yeah. For the moment, that's
cool. Well, I guess that's coming up to things chronologically. I mean, there's a bunch of other conversations I'd like to have with you at certain points, because I think there were conversations you had like with Bob Hoffman a bit, and I felt like you touched on it towards the end, but it didn't perhaps get explored as far as maybe I think you wanted to, about where digital is now. I'm not saying we need to necessarily have this conversation now, because it might be quite a long one, but you made this point about, you know, if you're not into digital, then there's an intrinsically Luddite wrong thing with you, even though there's all these things out there that you could try and you could do. There's both, you know, TV and posters and content and all these kind of things, but there's such a bias towards where digital is and what it is now, that combined with people who were good at other things, you know, in the recent past, that are still totally valid advertising avenues. It feels like things are in a really weird place that I don't think serve advertising as an industry or the work itself right now. And I don't know if I picked up on that in the wrong way.
I think there's a couple of issues with that, which is, I mean, I think still the most valuable and difficult task for a creative is I don't really like the phrase "the big idea," because I think rarely that do they seem big, these ideas that we hang things on. But is coming up with the idea that holds everything together and then executing it across all the disciplines is the sort of hardest thing. You know, so you see lots of work now that is a sort of basket of different shaped bits and pieces that don't really hold together or got nothing linking them. And I know that obviously some people think, well, because, you know, when I look around at how my kids behave with brands, they're not, you know, brands either stand for something and are attractive and they get them, or they don't. They're not really thinking, well, it's good that they're moving around, the Twitter is different from the posters and this thing's different from that, and it's all slightly disconnected. So I think, you know, I think arguably the sort of the role of art directors now is way more important than it used to be, because now you've got to figure out how you join together everything from a, you know, an Instagram feed, where if you're too overtly branded, people won't engage with it because there's too much other interesting stuff on there to start getting involved with marketing, to posters where you have to be dead simple and clear and, what you, you know, and overtly it is advertising, to, you know, you've got, or you may be creating a magazine or the content, and they all take different, what's the word, differently calibrated branding skills, which means you have to come up with something that can be, you have to not only calibrate it differently, you have to come up with something that can be calibrated differently, and you have to still work really hard in all those things. And I think that coming up with creative things, as much as let's hook up with them, let's get them to do this. I mean, it's a commissioning editor, I guess, as I was describing it earlier. But the most fulfilling thing, I think, being a creative has been dreaming up something that hasn't been done that affects people and that people see. You know, so if you've been in a cinema and your ad comes on, it's either terrifying, exhilarating, or some combination when you see people react to it. That's the great thing. When you, you know, a lot of stuff online, you've got no sense of how people react, really. You know, you may get some sort of printout of what happened on the site. But, and I don't know, you know, there's a lot of issues surrounding that. I think that, I don't know, is that in any way answered the thing that you thought we were talking about or didn't talk about? I think, or is it the fact that, you know, the other thing is that I think you can say different things if you're 25 to if you're 50. So I think if you're 50 and you say, why are we wasting money on Facebook? You know,
yeah.
My kids don't use it. They think, well, he just didn't get it. If you're 25 and you say, why are we wasting money on Facebook? None of my mates use it. It's like, well, that's interesting. Perhaps we should listen to it. So I think the information that you give out, if you're in my generation, is viewed differently, which is a sort of weird kind of, I think Bob called it a McCarthy-like thing, you know, where there's a sort of inbuilt issue with who's saying it and whether you're seen as traditional or modern or this thing or that. I mean, really, the job hasn't changed. It's changed, but it's not unrecognizable. That recently in a blog I wrote, and a few people said, oh, that's crazy to say that. It absolutely has. But essentially, you're trying to create things that light a little fire in someone's mind and that they remember and that they feel good about, and they can position the brand. And, you know, it doesn't matter what form it is. I don't think it's, you know, it's still very similar. A bit of a ramble, is that in any way?
Yeah, I think you did touch on the sort of point I was getting at. But I've just been reading so much of Bob's stuff recently, and on his Twitter feed, and I've just read his book as well. And it just feels like I never see any digital advertising that I like at all anywhere. And I see a lot of it, digital advertising, that I just hate and annoys the crap out of me, or is very poorly branded, or I don't even know what it's for or what it's trying to tell me. And it's got this kind of following wind behind it because it's digital. And people don't seem to apply the same standards to it because they go, oh, it's digital. You know, check it on Facebook. Great. People are going to see it. People are going to do something with it. But I don't think that they're, you know, when you'd have to create a poster 20 years ago, you'd have to really think about what was in it and how it was going to be seen and whether it was going to move people and be right for the brand and all this kind of stuff. Now it just feels like it goes into a Google algorithm and then a sort of square comes out at the other end on 3 million websites that you're not even aware of because you can't be. So it feels like that part of the process is somewhat different to me.
Well, I think also the thing that you remind me of there, which is that when you create a poster, the most difficult thing used to be, how on earth do you distill down the mountains of information into a single image and three words or four words, whatever. People don't seem to worry about that now. So most posters, you know, there was something I saw posted on Twitter or Facebook earlier that was an ad about come to this digital marketing conference to see how to really stand out. But there was like thousands of words that nobody would ever read. You know, the whole skill of distilling down people don't seem, I mean, I guess it's partly linked into the speed that you have to do things and the way that you change the structure of departments, but just simply saying the same thing but with five less words is a really useful skill, not just in posters but in everything, Facebook, Twitter, anything you care to mention. Trying to be, the less words you say, the more chance they have of getting through. And I think that's a sort of undervalued skill. You know, there's a sort of issue. I think people link copywriting, because it's got copy in the title, to writing copy at the bottom of a presser. But there's more writing needed today than by a copywriter than at any point. There's more copywriters need to write more words today than at any point before, and they can either be ones that work together really well and are really sharp and that are memorable, or they cannot. So that, and it's across so many more channels now. You know, you have to write tons of stuff for millions of things, including presentations now, that creatives would never have got involved in the past. So how you sell your stuff needs writing. Everything needs writing. But there's a sort of view that skill isn't as revered or as important as it once was, which is, I find, really strange. So there's not many people who are great at writing now, I think.
Okay, well, I think we've probably got to a good hour or so there. I don't know how much.
More gloomy note.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I didn't want to leave with the impression that digital advertising doesn't work or isn't right or anything, because there's some really, really great stuff out there. I think what I'm saying is I don't really see it in my day-to-day, so that's a bit of a shame.
No, I mean, I suppose I've always thought it's best to be cynical about everything. So if someone says, let's do some posts on that, you think, well, why would anyone look? Or would you see them? Or how much? You know, if you start cynically, it's better than assuming everything's going to work. But I think it's trickier starting cynically on digital stuff if you're over 40 than it is if you're under 40. But I still think that's the best way to sort of tackle things, to look at it how you see it through your daily life. If your kids, if your kids are not engaging with anything on posters or TV or whatever it is, factor it in. Don't just take, what you see in the brief at face value. Try and factor in what you observe. Something you bring to the party as a creative. You're sort of supposed to represent the public, not just say whatever the client view is.
Sure. Okay, well, thanks enormously. That's slightly better, slightly less down. That's sort of 83% down. So yeah, thanks a lot, and I'll cobble this together as usual and get it up on the oh yeah, do you want to send me the work as well, and I'll stick that up too.
You got a podcast to cut out there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay. Thanks very much, and
cheers, Ben.
Have a good day.
Good to speak to you. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
Podcast that was Christmas.